Okay, so let's summarize what we did in the last class. In the last class, we started with this kind of rotor model. So this is a rotor model. No, sorry, not this one. It's this Hamiltonian. This is a rotor model we started. Okay. So this looks complicated, but as I explained, this LZ is like an occupation number of a boson on the side. So this model actually describes a boson in the optical lattice. So the LZ tells us how many bosons on each, say, on each valley, on each side. Okay. So this LZ square is like an N squared term representing the repulsive interaction between bosons. Okay. This nu times LZ is like a nu times N term. And it's a chemical potential. When we're changing nu, we adjust number of bosons on each side. And this L plus L minus term from I and J representing the hopping of the boson. And in the optical lattice, we can tone the potential height. So we can tone the hopping tunneling amplitude. So JXY can be toned. Also, we can change boson number by changing the nu. So the nu can also be toned. So therefore, using this kind of a rotor model to study the boson in the optical lattice and try to see what kind of phase this boson can have. Okay. And in the last lecture, trying to obtain the phase diagram of this Hamiltonian, we start with the trial wave function. Or the variational approach. So in a sense, the variational approach is like a mean field theory, you know. And in this case, the particular variational approach we use is the one where involving three states, m into zero state, m into one state, m into minus one state. This m is LZ quantum number. So these three states can be viewed as a three state, like a n0 plus one state, n0 state, n0 minus 1 state. This n0 or n0 plus 1, n0 minus 1 is the number of bosons on each valley. Okay. So why we choose this? Because so one reason is following. If a JZ is very, very big, then this term prefer that m equal to 0. So that means they prefer each site just have n0 boson. N0 boson is the lowest energy state. We just prefer n0 boson on each side. So therefore, if Jz is very big, then in this variational approach, we find z1, z2 equal to 0. We only have this m0 component. So this is OK. But if you only have m equal to 0 states, then the boson cannot move. So when interaction is not so strong, when a tunneling Jxy is large, the boson can move around. So there is a n0 have fluctuations. So here we assume the fluctuation not too strong. So therefore, we introduce a z1, z2 to represent the fluctuation of a boson number some kind of a number n0. Okay. So here we see that we have two limits. The one limit is that the boson number fluctuation is very small. On every side, we just have an N0 boson, nothing else. Another limit is that fluctuation is very strong. So on each side, this N0 plus 1, N0, N0 minus 1, they all occur at similar amplitude. So it's kind of random. Yes?
How come the boson can move?
And how come the boson can't move if you only have m equals 0?
M equals 0. Oh, m equals 0 representing a state. You know, m equals 0 really representing a state, like n zeros. So that n zero means on each side we have a definite number of bosons. So boson number don't have fluctuation, no fluctuation. When the boson can move around, the ground state, it's a superposition of a boson on different positions. So ground state contains the fluctuation of a boson position.
So M has nothing really to do with spin?
Okay, this is the boson interpretation. And there's a spin interpretation. Okay, so now let's use the spin interpretation. So we can think of this as a Z component of spin. So in some magnetic material, you may have a Hamiltonian like this, which do not have a spin rotation symmetry. And so depending on the spin coupling, so this is Jz and Jxy are coupling between spins. Depending on spin coupling, sometimes the ground state may be mainly just m equals zero states, or sometimes if Jz, Jxy is big, the ground state is a superposition of m equal to 0 and 1 minus 1. So you can, so you know, when you have this kind of superposition, that's in the spin in the xy direction, no longer in z direction. Okay. So again, in the spin system, this kind of variational approach also is motivated. Means depending on the coupling constant, sometimes the spin point in z direction, but actually m to 0 z direction. It's not really z direction. But if the xy is very big, then the spin wants to point to the xy direction. So the spin wants to have different orientations. And this kind of variational wave function, when you're choosing different z0, z1, z2, indeed give you a spin in different orientations. So therefore, using this variational approach to minimize the average energy, we actually try to figure out what kind of spin orientation configuration would minimize energy. So that's we speak this kind of calculation in the spin language. So here, the boson number language or spin language, they both described by this same Hamiltonian. So you can use the same Hamiltonian, same method to study two different systems. Okay, some other questions? Okay. So once you have this set up, the calculation is pretty straightforward. You just plug this into here, just do the average. You just do the average. Okay. And the formula is very long. And as I mentioned that Z0i is not independent. We choose Z0i equal to Z1i absolute square minus Z2i absolute square. So Z0i is not independent. And so once you plug in, and we get a very complicated formula, actually. And this is already simplified, although it's still very complicated. And in this formula, we assume small z1, z2 limit. So we assume mostly it's m equal 0 state. There is a little bit m equal 1 and m equal minus 1 state. So we assume z1, z2 is very small. Then we expand the average energy to the quadratic order. So here I only write down the quadratic order. In the lecture notes, I also write down the quartic order. The quartic order actually is pretty important for the stability reason. And then there's even higher order term. But the quadratic order is this. So mathematically, you just minimize this energy. Then you find out what kind of spin orientation. Because once you know z1, z2, you know the spin orientation. So once you minimize this energy to find out what kind of z1, z2 minimize this energy, then you'll know what kind of spin configuration and what kind of boson configuration are described by the corresponding ground states. So that is the idea. So basically, this is a general way to find the phase diagram. You just get a tri-wave function, some kind of tri-wave function. The tri-wave function can be chosen such that it's easier to calculate average energy. You can start with some very complex tri-wave function, and nobody knows how to calculate average energy, then it's not very helpful. So for this particular tri-wave function, it's easy to calculate energy because this tri-wave function is a direct product state. So here, this is particular states on site I. And then on site J, another state. The total state is a direct product of the state on each site. So this direct product state is very helpful. It's easy to calculate the average energy for the direct product states. So that's why we choose direct product states, and we get this energy. And then, I'll summarize in the last lecture, we mentioned that if Jxy is greater than zero, then we want to maximize this term, maximize this inner product. So it turns out that to maximize that, the uniform configuration is favored. So the uniform z would minimize this energy. So therefore, we can drop the I and j dependence. So after you drop the I and j dependence, and we get this formula. So that is this energy expression became this energy expression, you know, after you drop I and j dependence. And from here, in the last lecture, again, we show that there is instability now. That is, if this quadratic form is a positive definite, if this form have two eigenvalues, both eigenvalues are positive, then this energy is minimized when z equal to z1, z2 equal to zero. But however, if you change the potential nu or changing jxy to make this quadratic form have one eigenvalue to be negative, then the quadratic, at a quadratic order, this Hamiltonian will not be bound from below. And the energy will be minimized by some non-zero z1, z2. And certainly here, this quadratic term became important. Otherwise, you get the energy will keep going down. But eventually, the quadratic term became important, and they stop, the z stop growing. Okay. So this is a typical symmetry breaking case. So when the quadratic term has two positive eigenvalues, it's kind of like the potential is minimized only when z equal to zero. And when the quadratic term have one of eigenvalue to be negative, you have something like this. And so the near the z equal to zero, the potential have this upside down quadratic form. So then the minimized by non-zero z. So that's this situation. And here I want to describe what's going on here. So actually, this is representing a phase transition. You know, when this quadratic term to have a positive or negative eigenvalue determined by is give us a phase transition. The condition for that is jz squared minus 8 jz jxy squared equal to mu squared. So this is a condition for the transition. So when this happens, one of eigenvalue become negative, become zero, and it goes through the transition. Okay. So we have two phases now. So we have two phases. So let me just present by a line. So depend on time potential or jxy, we have two phases. In one phase, we have a z equal to zero phase. In another phase, z not equal to zero phase. Basically, we have two phases. Okay. And here I want to say that somehow, you know, this Landau symmetry breaking theory play a role here. Because you have two phases of phase transition. And then you always ask, is there the symmetry breaking? You know, according to Landau theory, every phase transition associated with symmetry breaking. And the answer is yes. First, what kind of symmetry is broken? We notice that from this energy expression. We notice that we have a symmetry. We have U1 symmetry. Z1 goes to e to the I theta z1 I. Z2 I go to e to the minus I theta z2 I. So this is the U1 symmetry. Under this kind of changing phase, if you look at this, this expression is unchanged. For example, here we only have absolute value for z1, z2, they do not depend on the phase. But this cross term, you can see Z1 star Z2 is combined. So therefore, this combination under that transformation changed by a phase e to the minus I theta. But the Z1, Z2 star, this combination changed by phase e to the I theta, and these two cancel each other. So again, this term also independent of the phase. Okay, so therefore we have this phase transition. This is U1 symmetry. Then in this phase, it's a symmetric phase. Because the ground state is invariant under this transformation. And this phase is a symmetry breaking phase. Because ground state have a z not equal to zero. If z not equal to zero, then under this kind of rotation, the z would change. So again, we see that just like we see in the interacting boson case, we have two phases. One phase, we have U1 symmetry. Another phase, we don't have U1 symmetry. So therefore, an appearance of negative eigenvalue of this 2x2 matrix really gave us a U1 symmetry breaking transition. So we are describing a U1 symmetry breaking transition. Okay. So let me just draw the phase diagram of this. The phase diagram for this from this equation is so we have a nu over j x y, and the horizontal x is j z over j x y, and then the phase diagram is like that. And in the small, this is a z not equal to zero phase. This is z equal to zero phase. When jz is very big, we are in the z equal to zero phase. Okay, so this kind of U1 symmetry breaking transition actually represent a superfluid to multi-insular transition in the boson language. When the jz is very big, the ground state mainly just nz is zero, and that is a z equal to zero phase, z1 z2 equal to zero phase, and that phase is a multi-insulator phase. And then the other phase, you have symmetry breaking, is a superfluid phase. Okay, so now let's try to ask question. You know, how do you know one superfluid, one is multi-insulator? And so here I want to calculate the collective excitation or Lorentzian excitation in these two phases. So that is one point. So what I try to say is that, you know, right now we find that ground states, we try to, as a trial wave function, and we minimize energy, and we find some phase diagram. So now the question is that, can you tell me not only ground state, can you also tell me what kind of excitation in these two different phases? How to find out excitation? Right now we know the order parameter, we know the variational wave function, we know the ground state energy, but how about excitation spectrum? And the excitation spectrum, I really don't have too much room here. To obtain excitation spectrum, what we do is the following. We construct a Lagrangian using this ZIT. Okay. So we just follow what we discussed before, the coherent state approach. Okay. So we treat those z1, z2 not only as a variational parameter, like in the variational approach, we treat them as a dynamic variable of a classical system. Okay. So they have some time dependence. So in this variable approach, but they don't have time dependence. So now let's assume they have a time dependence. If they have a time dependence, we often ask, what kind of classical Lagrangian govern the motion, equation motion, of the time dependent z1 and z2? The answer is this. This is the answer. We can construct the phase space Lagrangian, and the equation motion of z1, z2 be governed by this phase space Lagrangian. The phase space Lagrangian contains two terms. One term is the minus energy term. And this term is a familiar term. We already calculated that. That is just average energy of these coherent states, or variational states. Certainly, they are function for z1, z2. So that's average energy. So we already have that. And we only need to calculate one more term, which is the Barrier's phase term. And once we put this Barrier's phase term and average energy term together, and then we get the Cartesian state Lagrangian. The Barrier's phase term actually is very simple. When you just plug in, you'll get this. The Barrier phase term is just I z1 i dot sum over I plus I z2 i dot. That is Barrier's phase term. Okay, so basically it's obtained by doing the following calculation. It's like a z1 star, z2 star. Maybe let me do this. z1 star, z2 star, I ddt z1, z2. It's basic. On each side, you do this calculation. Yes, expand this out, you get these two terms. Then the other term is minus this Hamiltonian. That's it. Okay. So therefore, the harder calculation is this one. It's the one we are familiar with. Just calculate average energy. And then you just add another calculation of the Barrier's phase. Okay. Then you get this phase-based Lagrangian in terms of those variable z. Z is like a coordinate in phase space. If you treat this as a classical system, z is like a coordinate in phase space. And then we get this phase-based Lagrangian. And using phase-based Lagrangian, we can do invariation to get equation motion. We can get equation motion for z. That is so the calculation in this example, it's pretty tedious. But on the other hand, it's pretty straightforward. OK. And what do we get? Well, we get something. It's very long, so I don't think I write on this blackboard. I will feel it. And I want to say the following. We can assume we can take a continuum limit because the ground state this z is uniform, so we can assume the low-lying extension comes from the long wavelength fluctuation. So in the long wavelength fluctuation, we can take continuum limit, and when we take a continuum limit. We obtain this kind of Hamiltonian. So this is the Hamiltonian we obtain when you're taking the continuum limit. So basically, so let's look at a few terms we have. So you can see we have the partial t term. This partial t term really comes from this the Barrier's phase term. So this is the Barrier's phase term on the lattice, and here we view this z as a function of x and t, some like a as a field in a continuum manifold. But then this bifurcated sum on lattice became this I partial t term in the continuum field theory. Okay. And we also have this a partial x term, partial x squared term. And we say, where does x derivative come from? The x squared derivative comes from this cross term. Okay. To see this more clearly, so let's consider the following thing. Suppose you consider zi star zj plus Hermitian complex conjugate. Let's consider this term. Okay. Then we ask, what is the continuum limit of this kind of expression? Okay. I try to say, well, the continuum limit of this expression is simple. It's just an integration for dx squared zi star of z star z. Okay. If z is uniform, so I'm really making some trivial statement. If z is uniform, then we can drop I and j, just z star z. And then the sum over I became integration over x. It's just this term. However, if z is not uniform, this quantity became smaller. We minus something. Because of the following, if z is not uniform, I side and j side, these two z are not really pointing in the same direction. They have some angle between them. And then, if z is unit vector, then this angle tells us that the inner product will be reduced by some cosine theta. And for small theta, reduced by something like a theta squared. And what is the theta? The theta is actually proportional to the change, to the gradient of z. That's a change. It is a change from I side to j side. This kind of change corresponds to the angle. And they reduce by something like that, so it's a absolute value square, because this is real. So basically, that's it. So this is kind of a trick we used. And for uniform, we get this. Then for non-uniform, because angle, there's some reduction, we find out the reduction, then we find that this is given by that. So that's how we get continuum limit. And so this is how we get this partial x term, and this partial x term, and this again. So these four terms are really obtained using this method. And certainly, this quadratic term also appear here. So I won't repeat it here. Okay. So at the end, what we have a field theory, although which is pretty complicated, but it's quadratic in z because we're doing small z expansion. So at the leading order, we got a quadratic field theory, quadratic in z. So we have a z squared term with some derivative. We also have some z squared term without some derivative. So that's basically the term we get. So the form of this field theory is very much like some simpler field theory you may see before. So let's write down some other simpler field theory, like z star I partial t z and plus, so minus, 1/2 partial x z abs value square. And say minus m square z abs value square. So if you treat z as a field, so this will be a simpler quadratic field theory. But this structure is very similar to what we have here. It have a linear time derivative term, have a quadratic spatial derivative term, and have a mass term, which is just purely a quadratic z term. So what we have here, just so it's more complicated, we have two components. We have z1, z2, that's it. Because two components, so therefore, the linear time derivative term and the quadratic spatial derivative term can be more complicated. And also, this mass term, this just pure quadratic, also more complicated. It's 2 by 2 matrix. We can have a mass of z1, z1, z2, z2, and we have a cross mass term, z1 and z2. You know. So, but on the other hand, is similar to this simple quadratic theory. Okay. So we can just doing something just like doing this scalar field theory now with two components. And we can obtain the equation motion, which I write down here. So this is the equation motion. Okay. So this equation motion contains the first order time derivative term, the second order spatial derivative term, and this is called the mass term. The constant term is like a mass term. Yes?
S2 symmetry?
No, we don't have S2 symmetry. We have only U1.
For V equals to zero, there isn't.
In this case, you know, you can do the SU2 transformation. You know, you can mix Z1, Z2 to do SU2 transformation. But this Hamiltonian is not invariant under such transformation. Mu equal to zero, no. Even for mu equal to zero, it's no SU2. And let me look at it. If mu equal to, I think there's a cross term. Yeah, I don't think they have SU2, yeah. Okay. So once you get this, we can get the equation motion. Once you get this motion is a linear equation. So therefore, you have two modes. So you have we can replace t partial t by say I omega and the partial maybe minus I omega partial x by the ik. You know, go to Fourier space, replace partial t by I omega partial x by ik, you get some kind of a 2 by 2 matrix. And then the zero eigenvalue of this 2 by 2 matrix tell you the dispersion relation. And you have because it's 2 by 2 matrix, you have two eigenvalues. So therefore, from these two eigenvalues, you can get a two dispersion relation. And the two dispersion relation is the main thing I just saw. Let me just write them down. The two dispersion relation we get is omega k equal to, let me do this, plus minus nu plus minus square root of 2jz jxy k square plus jz squared minus 8 jz jxy, sorry. Okay. This is the dispersion relation we get from this equation motion. Actually, I need to make a remark. First, this 2 plus minus sign can be taken independently. So actually, there's a four branch, four frequency. And we have four frequency because, you know, this equation only gave us two branch. Why we have four branch? Because the complex conjugate of this equation is another equation motion. That gave another two branch. So therefore, this equation motion plus its complex conjugate gave us a four branch. And the four branch have a frequency just a plus minus nu. Or maybe let's do this. We have a frequency can be plus minus of a nu plus minus is a square root. And so with this result, we can relate to the oscillator. So why we do this? We try to relate the oscillator. So what this result tell us? It tell us that the low energy excitation can be viewed as a collection for oscillator, just as before, as like the Fonon case. The oscillator are labeled by wave vector k. And for each wave vector, we have two oscillator, because we have two field, so we have two oscillator for each wave vector. And the frequency of two oscillator, just we drop this plasma matter sign. The frequency is always positive, so let's take drop plasma and take absolute value. So absolute value of this expression can be viewed as the oscillating frequency. So each k have two oscillator. One oscillator have a nu plus a square root. Another oscillator have frequency nu minus a square root. That's it. So that's really complete our discussion, you know, mathematical discussion, you know, what is a collective excitation in these two phases? Yeah, in this phase and in this phase. But what is the physics? The physics is that in this, it turns out that in the, okay, yeah, I had to say there's one thing I didn't say. The discussion only works in the z equals to zero phase. Because in this case, we expand around z equals to zero. We only keep a quadratic term in the z equals to zero. So therefore, this result only works in the z equals to zero phase. So what result we get? Actually, we'll pick a point and plug in, you'll find these two branch is this. We basically have two branch. So this is the k, this is omega. We just have these two branch. Basically, it's just, you know, there's some dispersion relation. You know, as k changes, the omega changes. And it's better to do this, make this plus minus nu. So this this gives you some kind of dispersion relation, and one branch is this mode move up a little bit, another branch is move down a little bit if nu is small. That's it. You have just two branches. Okay. Then what is interesting is that as we approach this transition point, as we approach transition point, for example, we can change in nu like this. We start from here, we just go vertically. We just change in nu to approach this transition point. And we change in nu, what happens is this two band split further. And eventually, at this point, dispersion leaving one branch touching, another branch still up there. So we see that as we approach the transition point, we get this quadratic dispersion relation and the gapless quadratic dispersion relation. And this is very similar to what we see in the boson superfluid case. In the inheriting boson case, we can also change the time potential. And there we can also have phase transition. We also see something like that. Okay. So therefore we can see this in a multi-insular transition. So in the optical lattice, as we change the time potential, then we can drive this kind of transition from the gap in the multi-insulator. You know, we call this phase multi-insular because every excitation is gapped. So it cannot respond to anything. So this is the insulator. Usually, insulator is characterized by the finite energy gap. Okay, so that's why it's insulator. And as we approach the transition point, the gap collapses. So at the critical point, it's no longer insulator. It's something else. It might be the conductor. Okay. What is interesting in the multi-insular case is that we could approach transition point along the nu equal to zero line. Along the nu equal to zero line, we find an interesting situation that along nu equal to zero line, along this line, the two dispersion relations happen to be degenerate. Because nu equal to zero, these two branches have the same energy. Okay. Then you'll say, well, then as you approach this critical point, you expect, well, this is, they're both going down. So you get something like that. Which is not true. When you look at this, it's very interesting. When you're nu to zero, when you're approaching transition point, that is when this constant term became zero. That is where translation happens. When a constant term became zero, dispersion relation became linear. So actually, at the translation point, it's a linear. You have two branches, but they are linear. So this is a, that's a little bit of a surprise. Okay. And the whole thing very much like along this mu zero line, that's very much like a relativistic theory. You can see when mu zero, the dispersion relation rather is like a k square root of k square plus a constant term. And this constant term is like m square. And as we approach transition, this m square became zero. So it's really like a relativistic dispersion relation. And as we're approaching the transition point, the dispersion relation became sharper and sharper at the bottom. But away for large k, it became linear again. OK. So then at the transition point, this touch zero, you get this. OK. And so basically, what I really try to say is that in condensed matter, we have two kinds of boson condensation. One kind of boson condensation is what we describe for interacting boson system, where as you from the insulating phase, uncondensed phase, approaching condensed phase, the transition point have a quadratic dispersion relation. This is non-relativistic. But there is another boson condensation is very much like this, like relativistic. And this is a boson condensation. This is, so in field theory, when people say boson condensation, people usually refer to this kind of boson condensation, symmetry breaking in field theory. So let me just erase this part. So in field theory, people usually have this partial t phi square minus partial x phi square plus phi m square term. You know, in this kind of field theory, if m, so maybe I add a phi 4 term. When m square changing sign, you say, oh, we have symmetry breaking phase transition. The ground, the vacuum have non-zero phi field now. So m square changing sign, and this kind of transition is very much like this transition along the mu to zero line. So therefore, the typical symmetry breaking transition discussed in the relativistic field theory is described in this boson multi-insulating system along this mu to zero line. Okay. So what is the condensed matter picture for such transition? The condensed matter picture is that along this line, there is a particle hole symmetry. You can see, so let's assume n equal to 0 as a reference. N0 plus 1 means we have a particle. N0 minus 1 means we have a hole. OK. So away from mu equal to 0 line, say along this line, then basically, the main fluctuations between n0 and n0 plus 1. So we don't have a particle hole symmetry. We just have a from n0 then to n0 plus 1, so like a particle condensation. Okay. But along mu to 0 line, we have something very special. For mu to 0 line, the n plus 1, n minus 1 have the same energy. But however, it is hopping prefer. They want n to fluctuate because the hopping want n to fluctuate. But the system don't know should they prefer a particle, should they prefer a hole. So therefore, the both particle and the hole are generated. If only particle are generated, you have a particle condensation. If only hole are generated, you have a hole condensation. But what happens if both of them are generated at the same time? And the system have a symmetry to say that the particle and hole are generated at equal amount. What is physics of that? That physics is this physics along z equal to 0 line. The transition is linear and relativistic. So this is a kind of a physics in this mounting transition. Yes. What quantum term? Yeah, because here we are talking about the approaching the transition, so the quantum term is not that important. When you go over that, that becomes very important. But you can say so far we only discuss z equals zero phase, and we are approaching this boundary, transition boundary. And we couldn't discuss what happened when you go over that. And so since you asked, I just want to say that when you go over that, you are really in the z, not in the zero phase. Then the calculation needs to be redone. You have to expand around a non-zero z with delta z. The calculation is even messier. But it can be done. And when you do that, you'll find in this phase, it's pretty simple. In the z, not in zero phase, the dispersion relation always, you have a linear and a quadratic, always this. So it's quite funny. That is, as you approach, along this z not to zero line, before transition, you have a two quadratic. At the transition, one branch touching zero. When you go over the transition, this branching touching zero became linear. That is the dispersion relation in the superfluid. Then, along the mu equal zero line, before transition, you have a two quadratic dispersion, which is degenerate. One for particle, one for hole. So now we understand why it has degenerate. Because the particle hole are kind of the same. So one for particle, one for hole. Then as you're approaching transition point, the vacuum or ground state contain equal amount of particle and equal amount of hole. And then they somehow, the particle hole condense at the same time at that time, at this transition point. So then you have the two linear dispersion mode. When you go over that, one mode remained to be linear, another mode became open the gap and became quadratic. So therefore, regardless, so in the z non-zero phase, regardless mu equal to zero, not equal to zero, dispersion relation always have same type, always just this. But in the z equal to zero phase, dispersion relation are different for mu equal to zero or mu not equal to zero. They are quite different. Okay, so this is basically the story about a magnet or the optical lattice in the boson. The basic message I try to present here is that we can do in a variational approach. We can design a variational state to obtain the Guangxi energy. And from the Guangxi energy to see whether do we have phase transition or not by simply examining whether Guangxi energy have singularity or not. And then if there's a phase transition, we can understand the phase transition to see whether there's symmetry breaking or not. What kind of symmetry is broken? What is the order parameter? In this particular case, we have a U1 symmetry I just described. The order parameter is Z1, Z2 is order parameter. In one phase, Z1, Z2 equal to zero. Another phase, Z1, Z2 not equal to zero. So that's the order parameter. And then after you get the phase, the next question you want to say, what about the collecting modes? The collecting mode is okay. You're just assuming those variational parameter to have a time dependence. And then construct this kind of phase-based Lagrangian using the energy calculated before plus the barrier phase you have to calculate in addition. Then once from that, you can get equation motion. From equation motion, you get the collecting modes. From the collecting modes, you can get the excitation spectrum in different phase. So that's kind of a program to study this many body system. So, however, here I just want to say that I think everyone will probably have a question. Why you choose this? and you can choose other things. So indeed, how do you know choosing this gave you right results? I don't know. So the things that so this is a physical intuition, and basically we need to understand the system to a certain degree and know what kind of variational answers to choose. And here I want to emphasize that The variation unsat we choose here is a direct product state form. And almost all the mean field theory in condensed matter physics have this kind of a choice of a variational state. They all direct product states. And then, and there's a parameter in the direct product states. You know, some of them became other parameter. And so this essentially layer the foundation to understand the phase and phase transition and signature breaking and et cetera. However, in the next class, we are going to consider another rotor system. It's still we have rotors LZ and L plus L minus. But the interaction is modified. We design another interaction. And in that rotor system, we will see that this choice of a variational unsat system is no longer very good. Actually, it's very bad. And so we have to choose a different variational unsat. We have to consider things differently. And but however, but once you choose a different variational unsat, you can still carry out this this program. And but there we'll see that the collect mode can be very different, and so this will be the emergence of Maxwell equation. And what I try to say that you can see here we already see the emergence of two equations. One equation is this field theory, relativistic field theory. Okay. Then that's around the nu to zero line. When nu not equal to zero, we see a non-relativistic field theory. That's not L. So nu to zero, this system have a relativistic field theory, a scalar field theory. When you not equal to zero, you can see near the critical point, we only have one branch have a low energy. So this single low energy branch have a quadratic dispersion relation. So therefore, it's described by this non-relativistic field theory, where time derivative is the first order, spatial derivative is second order, and you have mass term. And this is relativistic field theory if you go along this nu to zero line. But the one thing is that both field theory is a scalar field theory. Okay, so therefore it's very easy to have some kind of scalar field theory emerge from some kind of interacting magnetic system or a quantum boson system. And but in next class we'll study a similar rotor system with different interaction, and to show that even this a gauge theory, where you have a described a vector potential, can emerge from this rotor system. The key point is that if you start with direct product states, you never have an emergent gauge theory. You always have some emergent scalar theory. But however, if you go beyond the direct product states, then you can have emergence for other more weird theory, you know. It's pretty clear that the gauge theory can emerge if you start from something non-direct product. And we don't know whether the gravity theory can emerge or not. That's a current research direction. And also the fermion can also emerge, but I will not discuss fermion here. Okay, I think I will stop here.